My name is Eric Bowe, and welcome to the Primal Shopper Podcast. This podcast is for marketers, entrepreneurs, and academics interested in understanding why we shop the way we do. My goal is to focus on primal motivations driving our behaviors and how to apply learnings to improve your marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. I'll include any links in the show notes. Also, there is plenty of bonus content on primalshopper.com. Finally, if you want an in-depth perspective, my book, Primal Shopper, is available on Amazon and other sites. Now let's get on with the show. This episode is the final episode of the four I am doing as a part of releasing my new book. In the previous several episodes, I covered the what and the why. The what is the shopper DNA, and the why is why we actually shop the way we do. In the last episode, I covered this shopper DNA and the impact it has on today's marketing tactics. I discussed how you need to really look at the shopper DNA to figure out what tactics would work within your product category and what tactics honestly would just be seen as white noise from the shopper perspective. The final episode is also the final part of the book. It's about activating the primal shopper. I'm going to talk about four different things in this episode. The first is the two mindsets you need to market for conversion, and those two mindsets are attitudinally and behaviorally. The next thing I'm going to talk about is passion platforms, which really gets into the attitudinal movement and creating desire. Also, I'm going to talk about decision optimization. If you take a step back and look at a shopper journey, specifically for mid and high consideration purchases, what you're going to find is a series of decisions somebody makes as a part of choosing what product to buy. We're going to talk a little bit about the decision path that people go through and then how to optimize it. And last but not least, I'm going to talk about the shopper sandbox, which really, this switches gears a bit and gets into my other passion. Two passions I have is really consumer behavior and organizational behavior. So in the shopper sandbox, I'm going to talk about how to actually get the most out of the organizations who are coming up with ideas in the retail and marketing environments by looking at different behaviors that exist today in agencies. So with that said, let's get on with the episode. Part four of this series and part four of the book is about activating the primal shopper. Just like I read in the other ones, I'd like to read through this intro chapter, and as with the others, it starts with a quote. And this quote is from Ron Johnson, who is a Canadian politician, and he is quoted as saying, "It's always about mind share, not about market share." And this is an important point because often people look at their market share and how much they have relative to everybody else. But when we talk about primal shopper, it's about the mindset share. It's about the mind share and really optimizing based on this. Because here's reality, folks, you are not going to appeal to every shopper out there. The question is, what shoppers do you appeal to, and what is your shopper share of those people? Say that quick, really, 10 times. Good luck with that. Anyway, I write in this the following. The marketplace is full. Imagine a large rectangular box drawn on a whiteboard. The box represents the entire market for a specific industry. What industry we're talking about really doesn't matter, but for the sake of our discussion, let's choose grocery stores. The grocery marketplace is split into many puzzle pieces representing the market share for each grocery brand. Each brand wants to increase share. They want to make their puzzle piece bigger. There are only two ways this will happen: take share from someone else or get more people to grocery shop. Odds are there isn't going to be a surge of new grocery shoppers, so the box isn't getting any bigger. This means the brand needs to steal share from the competitor. They need to give the competitor shoppers a compelling reason to switch. The reality is there are plenty of grocery shopping options for most people. And many of these shoppers already have a go-to grocery store or a rotation they use to stock up on produce and meat. As well, most people are probably content with their options. It is doubtful anybody is sitting at home saying, "Geez, I wish there was another grocery store I could go to." So, to get share, a grocery brand needs to get the shopper to rethink their habit, their rotation. The marketing needs to be disruptive enough that shopper takes notice and evaluates the new store relative to their current choices. Disruption's a bit of a tired word, but it is important to understand what I mean. Disruption in the holistic sense would change the marketplace. A brand would create a new offering or product that would redefine the category. The brand market shares in our grocery box would be partitioned based on the new paradigm. in the grocery category, this could be the growing use of e-commerce, whether it is Amazon Prime or Kroger's ClickList, where the store packs the groceries and loads to your car. The proliferation of e-commerce alternatives may redimensionalize the share of cart, especially for mission shoppers who view grocery shopping as a chore. This is not, however, the disruption I'm referring to. The disruption I am focused on is disruption of people's habit or behaviors. This kind of disruption is necessary to move the shopper attitudinally, to get them to consider a new product. Normally, disruption occurs through interrupt channels like television, online video, direct marketing, or word of mouth. Video has the sensory capacity to engage a viewer, but the message needs to be a provocation to get the person to rethink their choice. Word of mouth as an interrupt mechanism is even more powerful, yet harder to do. If somebody lauds their brand or purchase or experience, there is no better form of marketing. Believability and relevance are why it's so powerful. Usually the person doing the advocating is known to the recipient and therefore believable, especially if they are someone the recipient trusts. Secondly, the communication can be more relevant since the participants know each other. Remember my mother's Aldi experience that I talked about in a previous chapter. Aldi's marketing did not persuade her. What persuaded her was a conversation with a group of women who have advocated for two brands, Aldi and Costco, as the stores with the best deals. Moving the shopper attitudinally is only half the equation. A marketer must also move them behaviorally. To do so, the marketer must speak to the shopper DNA. It's a combination of getting the shopper to try the product the first time and then reinforcing the behavior in the future. In the previous chapter, I talked about the consideration clip, the point of which marketers were able to move the target attitudinally but failed to convince the shopper to buy the product. Intercept channels are critical in moving the shopper behaviorally. Such channels are the primary sources a shopper uses to make decisions. The sources could be online, traditional, or within the retail store itself. The channels will change by product because of the differences in the decision path to the final choice. This section tells you how to activate the principles and practices outlined in the book. The first two chapters focused on the nuances of moving a target attitudinally. The next two chapters outline how to create powerful experiences to influence the shopper's decision. The final chapter is an introspective look at the ad agencies and how to deliver an integrated channel. So, as a core part of that introduction, I focused on this concept of two mindsets. You need to move a shopper both attitudinally and behaviorally. So I'm going to sort of kick this podcast, this part off, by really getting into that a little bit and give you an example of it at the same time. Let's talk about attitudinal movement first. Really, attitudinal movement is when somebody is thinking about a purchase, and often you don't know as a marketer because they haven't behaviorally identified themselves. So I don't care if you're thinking about going on a trip, buying a new car, buying a grill, whatever it may be. What you're doing when you're thinking about the next purchase attitudinally is you're building your consideration list. You're building what product features, and what brands you should consider. And as I said, this movement is silent because they're thinking. This is where marketers use interrupt media to actually get on the consideration list because they don't know who's in market or who is not at any given time. So the timing for this is always on. What I mean by that is because people are thinking about it, you don't know if they're thinking about something next year or next week. So unless it's a seasonal type of product purchase, you usually have to be always on in some capacity in order to make sure you're becoming a part of that person's consideration list. And what you're marketing to at this point and what you're linking to is the customer's desire. And this is critical because it isn't just saying your product exists. You need to create that emotional connection that when they get down to purchase, when they move forward in deciding, you already have that emotional connection. Just because you have it doesn't mean you'll win, but you need that to at least be in the race. Now, this gets me to the second mindset, which is behavioral. Behavioral is when somebody's actively deciding what to buy. Sometimes they just decide by looking through things offline or talking to people, whether in their social circle or in their family. Many times we consider purchases, they may be going online and looking for information to help them make a decision. What they're gaining is knowledge here, and this is very important to understand. They're not just looking for any information. They're trying to gain knowledge. They're trying to get advice on what is the best option for them. Now, the timing on this is prior to purchase, obviously. Sometimes you're going to have a longer lead time than others. For example, with buying a new car, you may have upwards around 3 months, if not longer. Travel could be several months. But sometimes you're going to go and, let's say, I don't know, your garage door opener breaks. Your lead time may only be days in which to intercept them and move them towards your product. With behavioral, you're marketing to the shopper DNA. So we're talking about the importance of brand versus free agent. Is this person a deal seeker versus price blind? Are they a mission or journey shopper? And it's very important to understand this because this is when I talk in the intro about shopper share. You can take any product category and break it into shopper share. You can also look at your brand to figure out, well, what is the composition of my brand relative to shopper DNA? And by linking the two together, you really get the idea of how much share can I gain within my product category? Who am I appealing to? Who am I not? For example, if you look at grocery, about two-thirds of the people who shop are deal seekers, the other third is price blind. So if you're somebody like Whole Foods, you really need to dominate the price blind category. I know they talk about getting deal seekers, and they're always tried different things along this line, but the reality is Whole Foods is not a discount brand, nor should they be. But at the same time, given that roughly about a third of the people are price blind, that's their shopper share. And trying to get shoppers from Kroger, from Aldi, from Lidl, from Walmart, for Whole Foods is a very large task. Maybe they could do it. I don't know. Most likely they're going to be getting their shoppers from a Trader Joe's or getting them from a Publix, getting it from more of the price blind brands out there. So this sort of gives you an idea of the two mindsets. And these two mindsets are critical because as I go through the last section of the book, I touch on each one of them because you need to do both. Obviously, if you're not connected with the customer desire, you're not even going to be in the race, as I just said. And just as importantly, even if you're in the race, if you do not market to their shopper DNA, specifically that's in the product category, there's no guarantee they're going to choose your product versus the competition. So that sort of recaps the two mindsets a little bit and sets up really then how the rest of this section goes and how you convert based on both of these mindsets. One of these chapters is Passion Platforms and is based on a lot of my travel experience. Although you can extrapolate the thought process to other product categories, the examples I use in this chapter are primarily travel. With that said, let me just talk about what a passion platform is. Because there's really, you can take a look at any travel or any product, and often you look at it two ways. Is it a need or a want? Is it more of a utility versus a desire? And based on that, you're going to get very different results. Now, you go, well, at what point is like travel just a need? Well, you can think of, well, I need to go on business, or I just need to go visit the in-laws or something like that, and I'd rather stay in a hotel. So it's a need versus a desire, although you might want a desire to stay in a hotel versus your in-laws. That's your call. The example I want to talk about is some work I did probably about 5 or so years ago with Mackinac Island. For those of you who aren't aware of what Mackinac Island is, it's in Michigan. It's between the Upper and Lower Peninsula, right by the Mackinac Bridge. And it's this island that's sort of been frozen in time. There are no cars allowed on the island. There's horse-drawn carriages. You can only get there by ferry. And it's very eclectic and interesting. One of the key features then is this big grand hotel that's been featured in several movies. Bottom line is when you work with any client, you usually ask, what's the problem? You know, where's your gap? What are we trying to do with your marketing? And they said, well, here's our problem. We have two types of travelers. We have a day traveler and a stay traveler. And we're not getting enough people staying overnight. People typically come for the day, they take the ferry over in the morning, they do their stuff, and they leave. So the question we have is, how can we use our marketing to convert the day to stay? Great thing, because your overall revenue you're going to generate, obviously, from a stay traveler is going to be a lot more because they're there longer, you're getting a hotel night, at least one, if not more. What I did is I went out and I took a look at a digital ethnography. So I looked at social media. In this case, I looked at about 60 to 80 blogs. Half of them were people who went to Mackinac Island for the day. Half of them were people who stayed at Mackinac Island. And something really interesting started to emerge. First, from a day traveler perspective, you read it and you almost feel like you're hyperventilating because they would talk about all the attractions they did, how they went to the fort, they did the fudge, how it was a hectic schedule. They would complain about the cost of activities. Also, it was always about time. I mean, what I mean by that is it would go, we did this, we did this, we did this, we did this, and we got to the 6:25 ferry just in time to get back to the mainland. It also included the grand hotel visit. And as you can imagine, the focus not only on what they said, but the photos were predominantly on the iconic sightseeing on the island. If you were to sum all of this up, we called it Fairy's Fort and Fudge because it was about the fairy. You had to go to the fort, and if you ever had, if you like fudge, you've got to try Mackinac Island fudge. It's awesome. So it's very much a check the box mentality. So let me juxtapose the day traveler with the stay traveler. Very different. The stay traveler, there was this. They talked about the ambiance of the island. It was multisensory. There was always a relaxing. It was a leisurely pace. They talked about the quality of the experience, whether it was the restaurants, the hotels, the walks. It seemed to have a timeless nature to it. And maybe they went to the Grand Hotel, but unlike the day traveler, the Grand Hotel was something you sort of did if you felt like it. And it was a getaway. So you really felt these people, and I know it's a little cliched, but they were unplugging, where you felt the other people were just, I don't know, where you felt the other people were anything but a getaway because of the hectic schedule. Well, the phrase we put to this was food, photos, and foot pass, because you looked at the pictures they took, you look at how they talked about the food. They took a lot of photos off the beaten path. Sort of to wrap this one up, the thought process was leave your checklist behind. So you have the day, which was check the box, and then you have the stay was leave your checklist behind. Now here's where the interesting twist was. When you looked at their advertising, it felt like the day traveler. It was like very much boom, boom, boom. It's like a very fast-paced vignettes of what you can do on the island. Really, it turned out to be how people experienced the island. To switch this, what we worked with, what they needed to do was create more of a weekend experience, more of a getaway experience that was centered around an anchor activity. So instead of trying to do A, B, C, D, E, F, like a very fast-paced itinerary, it was like, why don't you come? We're going to have a music weekend or do a getaway wedding there. Or this is a great place to do your anniversary. Really positioning Mackinac Island as an extended getaway as opposed to a hyper itinerary that you needed to get done and get back as soon as possible. So that sort of gives you an idea of how do you move from the need, which is I need to do all these activities, sort of check the box, very family oriented, to the desire. This desire could be more passion-based. This is where passion platforms come from, meaning it's a passion around architecture. It could be a passion around music, art. It also could be a passion for your significant other as a romantic getaway. You're really trying to connect with these people on an emotional level, on a desire level, and casting your destination in something that becomes an option for them. So that sort of gives you an idea of passion platforms and how you would possibly go about creating a desire for a specific, in this case, destination or product. The next topic I want to talk about is decision optimization. To get into this first, I need to talk a little bit about the decision path. For those that haven't heard of previous podcasts, a decision path is a series of decisions somebody makes when buying a product. Now, if it's a low consideration purchase, there's very few, maybe just one decision. But as you get to mid and high consideration, you end up with more decisions. So for example, with automotive, when I worked in that, we identified over 20 macro decisions somebody makes as part of buying a vehicle. For travel, there's roughly about 10. For grocery shopping, there are 5 decisions we make on a regular basis, which is interesting because most people don't think about that. The reason people have decisions is because rarely does somebody only go to one grocery store. So they're trying to figure out, what do I need? Where can I buy it? Who has the best deals? You get the idea. Let's go back to automotive for a second. I really want to talk about a project I did for an automotive company in the last several years. The goal of it was to figure out how effective their website was in converting shoppers to buyers. So were they moving the needle, in other words? With an automotive website, specifically a manufacturer's like a Ford, a Chevrolet, a Toyota, usually you don't get direct sales from them unless somebody orders a vehicle. And normally Americans don't order vehicles online, at least not today. What we do is usually pick them up at the dealership. However, you can look at a website and figure out, is it moving the needle? Is it answering the decisions a shopper has as a part of their process and putting my brand in a more favorable light? So what we did is we took the 20 plus decisions and had a little pop-up survey and asked them a lot of questions, including, well, why are you here today? And they would check off what decisions they were trying to do. At the same time, this survey was pixeled into the website so we could see specifically where did they go on the website to actually figure out these decisions they were trying to do. And then finally, we asked several questions, one of which was, based on your decision today, what is the likelihood of you buying this brand of vehicle? Are you more likely, neutral, or less likely? So one of the targets we were looking at was people who are cross-shopping, and it's an important target for any brand. It doesn't just need to be automotive. For this specific website, roughly about a third of the people were cross-shopping between brands. For example, if it was a Ford, if you were on a Ford site, they were cross-shopping between Ford and Chevy or Ford and Toyota. You get the idea. And what we did is we looked at what were they doing on the site, and there was something very interesting that was coming out on that. And then we also looked at, well, based on this web experience, how likely were they now to buy a Ford versus prior to the visit? Let's start with the last question first. About 33% of the people were more likely to buy that brand based on their web experience. So the client looked at this and he exclaimed, that's a 67% failure of this website. And he's right. If somebody willingly and actively goes to your brand website to buy your product and you only move 33% forward, that's not good. That's not good at all. And so he was very captivated. What do we do about this? Which gets me back to the first question. Where do these cross shoppers go? Where do they go on the website to actually determine if this is the right brand for them? An interesting nuance happened, because what we were able to do is look at all the different sections of the site somebody went to. Did they go look at photos? Did they go to build in price? Did they look at the comparator tool? Did they go look at vehicle details? The number one place they went was build in price. That was interesting. But what was even more interesting, compare vehicles didn't even show up. So while automotive companies are putting compare tools on their website so you can compare their brand versus the competition, these people who were literally comparing as a part of buying did not access that brand's tool. Now, it makes sense from a certain perspective, is that there's a certain skepticism many times when a brand tries to be, where brands try to be transparent. So for example, if a brand puts reviews on their site, people tend to look at them a little bit like, okay, are you filtering these reviews? You know, what are you really doing here? As opposed to looking for reviews or looking at a comparison tool on a neutral site like a Kelley Blue Book and Edmunds, Yahoo Cars, where these sources from a shopper perspective are seen more objective in how they actually approach the data. So anyway, back to the story. So they didn't go to the compare tool, but they did go to build your own. And immediately the client's reaction was, well, we need to put in here why our brand is better for every vehicle versus the key competition. It's an interesting reaction, but not really the right one, because what this person is doing, what this shopper is doing, is they're shopping until they find the right product for them. And often I like to use the dating metaphor for this. So for example, most people, right, go on record for this, don't invite multiple women or multiple men to a single date, unless you're like on The Bachelor or Bachelorette. Typically, you date one person at a time till you find the one that's right for you, till you find the one that you want to spend some time with. Think about it. How's this really different than buying a product? You're looking until you find the one that feels right. You find the one that's right for you. So thinking about that client's reaction, what we talked about, well, instead of trying to say why you're better, try to become more relevant. Try to become that car to the point where they want to marry you, they want to buy you. And so this sort of sent us on a different path of thinking, well, how do we increase the relevancy in the car shopping experience to this website? So we do two things. One, ultimately, we are seen as the car for them. In doing so, as you can imagine, what you're going to find out is you're going to increase that likelihood to purchase from the 33% level to a lot higher. So it sort of gives you an idea of understanding what decisions people take, how you can actually look at a specific channel and optimize it based on what these people are coming in to figure out, and therefore figuring out what content you need to create that emotional connection, and therefore increase the likelihood that they're going to purchase your product in the end. So that's decision optimization. The last subject I want to talk about is, it could probably be a book in and of itself. It's called The Shopper Sandbox. And why do I call it The Shopper Sandbox? It's because in my career, I have facilitated over 1,000 brainstorming sessions for automotive, travel, retail, and many products in between. And from all these sessions, I can tell you that the nuances of the agency relationship today are not working. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the primary one is that everybody has their own forte. Everybody, every agency is known for something. And human nature, even if you have the best intentions, human nature would dictate you want to pull the conversation to what you're comfortable doing. For example, if you're a TV person, you're going to want to pull the conversation and let's create a commercial. If you're a digital person, you're going to talk about either creating a website or maybe social activation. And if you're an event person, you're going to talk about here's how we can actually bring this to life in the real world. Nothing is wrong with that. But this becomes magnified when you work at an agency that's only known for one thing, which gets me to the story of Team Detroit. I was hired into Team Detroit roughly in about 2007. And at that time, my role was to get these agencies to work together, primarily through facilitating brainstorming sessions and really working with them on how to create integrated campaigns. And this is something I was doing prior to that, and I still do to this day. The interesting thing about this was to get these people to work together, I had to get them out of their tendencies. I had to get them working together for something bigger than themselves. To do this, I had to find a way to make the brainstorming sessions really more neutral or idea-centric. And sometimes it's easier said than done. People use idea-centric a lot in our industry, and that's fine. But by and large, people confuse ideas with channel ideas and the like. And just on a side note, there's an old adage out there that there's no such thing as a bad idea. Well, let me tell you, there are plenty of bad ideas. And the reason mostly because they're bad ideas is because there's no boundaries around the ideation. And what I like to call it is you need a sandbox. The sandbox is it prevents people from what I call free-range chicken ideation, where they're just generating a lot of ideas, and then they'll go and they'll pick them and stuff like that. Well, if you get people in the room, if I get people in the room, I don't want to go wide. I don't want to run around like chickens. I want to go deep, and I want to come up with ideas that solve the problem, ideas that dimensionalize an opportunity. To do so, you need a sandbox. You need boundaries. And in the book, I talk about 4 guidelines for this. Now, again, this is directional. I use this in different ways, but just to give you an idea of how this could work. The first one is, what is the brand idea? When I say brand idea is when I'm doing a integrated channel strategy and there's no brand idea, literally there's no wrong answer. And I had several brainstorming sessions on vehicle launches where this occurred, where we were brainstorming on something, but because there was no, you know, North Star, which I really don't like that word, but there was no centering point to say this is right or wrong, we just had tactical vomit. It was ridiculous. So you need that brand idea. And by the way, when you're coming up with a brand idea, you would have a different sandbox than the one I'm talking about now, but let me continue. The second thing you need is the primal motivations, meaning what are the shopper desires? What is the shopper motivations of people who actually purchase a vehicle? You know, you're going to get a lot of different things here. It's people who are brand citizen versus free agent. I mean, you're going to get the Ford advocates when I was working for Team Detroit. You're going to get the people who love a specific vehicle like Mustang. So other people are all about deal seeking or about their monthly payment. And they'll say, you know, I don't care if it's a Chrysler. I don't care if it's a Chevy. I don't care if it's a Ford. You hit $200 or $300 in my monthly payment, I'm in. So in this case, the deal is actually driving their decision making. You need to know how much of this is this, because otherwise you can come up with a great idea. However, if they're fixated on the monthly payment, this idea really wouldn't work for you. The third side of our sandbox is the decision path. So where are we solving for? Is this more of earlier on in the decision-making process? Because usually with a vehicle, there's 3 stages: my needs, my car, my price. So what are we doing? Are we talking about earlier up, where we're trying to influence their needs, more of that attitudinal mindset? Are we trying to influence their journey, trying to intercept them, which is more about my car and actually finding the cars right for them? Or are we going down to the dealership and we're talking more about price, pricing options, different ways to do pricing to appeal to the different pricing mindsets? This decision path, as you can imagine, is going to get you to different territories based on where are you focused within the path itself. And just as importantly, which goes with the decision path, is the last side of our shopper sandbox, which is influential channels. So what channels does that shopper rely on to make these decisions? Let's just be clear about this. This isn't just what channels do they use. It's what channels influence them in their vehicle purchase, in the case of buying a new car. So how much was the auto show up factor? Websites, third-party sites like KBB and Edmunds. How much of it was word of mouth? How much of it was going to the dealership and test driving? How much of it was a dealership experience? The idea must be able to be extrapolated to the relevant touch points in order to affect the final decision. So again, this is just your basic sandbox of starting with the brand idea, the shopper DNA. The third side is the decision path. And finally, the influencer channels. By using these four sides to the sandbox and converging it and focusing your brainstorming, I'll tell you, the results are amazing of the ideas you come up with versus saying, hey, we have to sell a new blank, which is just back to free range chicken ideation. And no offense, but good luck with that. So with the shopper sandbox, that concludes this episode and also includes the four-part series to sort of launch my new book, Primal Shopper. So with that said, first off, thanks for listening. I really appreciate those of you out there. If you enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you to subscribe to future episodes on primalshopper.com or subscribe to your favorite podcast. We're on iTunes, Anchor, Google, and the like. Also, if you're looking to apply Primal Shopper to your marketing, feel free to contact me on LinkedIn, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have about Primal Shopper. With the conclusion of this four-part episode, I thought about also maybe switching up the format a little bit. So I've got some thoughts myself on different things to try in upcoming podcast episodes. However, if you have any ideas, reach out to me on LinkedIn, or you can email me at eric@ericbow.com. I'm eager to hear any suggestions you have. So, well, that's it for now, folks. Until next time, this is Eric Bow on the Primal Shopper Podcast. Later.